Member Hansen.
Thank you. The Board is issuing today a concept release to seek comment on ways that auditor independence, objectivity, and professional skepticism could be enhanced. It is appropriate now, 8 years after the reforms established by the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, to consider whether more should be done to enhance auditor independence, and if so, what the appropriate measures would be. Nevertheless, I believe we should proceed cautiously along this path. The primary focus of the concept release is mandatory auditor rotation. Before we determine whether that is in the best interest of investors and the public, we need to weigh carefully whether its benefits would outweigh its costs and potential unintended consequences. We also need to further analyze our inspection results and other available information to determine whether audit efficiencies are attributable to a lack of auditor objectivity and skepticism, and, if so, whether those symptoms are best remedied through mandatory auditor rotation or some other measure. I look forward to what I know will be a thoughtful and thorough comments in response to the concept release to help the board consider all the relevant aspects of this important issue. As has already been mentioned, Sarbanes-Oxley in the Section 207 required that the United States General Accounting Office conduct a study to review and the potential effects of requiring the mandatory rotation of registered public accounting firms. And in November 2003, the GAO issued a report that stated, among other things, that the GAO did not believe that audit firm rotation was the most efficient way to strengthen auditor independence and suggested that it would be appropriate for the SEC and the PCAOB to monitor the effectiveness of the Act's requirements for several years before determining whether further independence requirements are needed. We now have several years of experience as contemplated by the GAO report. Since its creation in 2003, the board has conducted hundreds of inspections of registered public accounting firms each year. These inspections provide the board with unique insight into the state of the audit profession and the conduct of public company audits. Based on this insight, the board believes the reforms in the Act have made a significant positive difference in the quality of public company auditing. Indeed, any auditor, financial executive, or audit committee member that was involved with public company audits prior to the enactment of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act can tell you how different the auditing profession and audit committees are today compared to 10 years ago. This is due primarily to the reforms of the Act and the activities of the PCAOB. Nevertheless, the board's inspections continue to find audit deficiencies. Room for improvement in audit quality remains. The board continuously strives to drive improvement in audit quality through inspections, requirements for remediation, disciplinary action, and standard setting. We consider the underlying causes for the deficiencies identified by our inspectors and the risk posed by an ever-changing environment, and we ask ourselves what more can we do and should we do to improve audit quality. Because the independence of auditors from their clients is critical to their effectiveness and credibility, perhaps more critical than any other single factor affecting audit quality, Congress, the SEC, and the PCAOB have established many specific requirements related to auditor independence. The concept release we are issuing today asks whether even more action is warranted to enhance auditor objectivity and skepticism, and if so, what form such action should take. Unlike other concept releases issued by the board, such as the concept release issued earlier this year on the changes to the auditor report, I see this release more as a vehicle to gather information and spark discussion than as a step towards a board proposal for a new or amending auditing standard. The release seeks information on a variety of important issues, including the significance of problems with auditor independence, the potential effectiveness of mandatory auditor rotation or other measures in addressing such problems, and the likely costs or unintended consequences of mandatory auditor rotation or other measures. I would like to highlight a few areas in which I believe comments would be particularly helpful. First, although auditor rotation was specifically singled out in the Sarbanes-Oxley Act and GAO report and has been the subject of much debate over the years, I would encourage commenters to provide their views and relevant factual information relating to any potential measure to improve auditor independence, objectivity, and professional skepticism. While the concept release focuses on mandatory rotation as a potential remedy, we are open to other ideas, and I encourage you to include in your comments and other potential measures, whether intended to supplement or replace mandatory auditor rotation. Secondly, I am particularly interested in comments about the role of the audit committee in ensuring auditor independence, including through voluntary auditor rotation and the real-life experiences of of audit committees that have considered or implemented audit rotation. The GAO report pointed out that audit committees have increased responsibility under the Sarbanes-Oxley Act and can play an important role in enhancing auditor independence. The report cited a report by the Conference Board Commission on Public Trust and Public Enterprise for the proposition that audit committees should carefully consider voluntarily rotating firms when, one, significant non-audit services are provided by the auditor to the company, two, one or more former partners or managers of the audit firm are employed by the company, or three, the auditor of record has had a lengthy tenure, such as for over 10 years. The GAO report stated it would be appropriate in those situations for the audit committee to consider whether a fresh look, i.e. a new auditor, is needed. According to the GAO report, many of the benefits of audit firm rotation could be realized at the initiative of audit committees rather than through a mandatory rotation requirement. I would be interested in comments from audit committee members, investors, issuers, auditors, and others about whether the framework contemplated by the GAO report in 2003 has been effective. Do audit committees, in fact, consider auditor tenure in evaluating their auditor's independence? For those audit committees that have considered rotating their auditor based on tenure, did you ultimately decide to implement term limits for your auditor? What factors did you consider in your decision? Do investors believe that audit committees are living up to the expectations of the GAO report, or should the decision to rotate auditors based on tenure be taken out of the hands of audit committees through the establishment of mandatory rotation? I'm going to repeat that one. Do investors believe that audit committees are living up to the expectations of the GAO report, or should the decision to rotate auditors based on tenure be taken out of the hands of audit committees? Finally, I'd be interested in views about the timing of the board's consideration of measures to improve audit quality. On page 17 of the release, the following question is posed. Should the board simply defer consideration of any proposals to enhance auditor objectivity, independence, and professional skepticism? While you might consider this just as a question in terms of board priorities, I believe the question should also be considered in light of the current state of audit regulation. The board has issued a number of important auditing standards recently and continues to work on several others. All are designed to improve audit quality or transparency. For example, in August 2010, the board adopted a suite of 8 audit standards related to the auditor's assessment of and response to risk in an audit. In July 2009, the board adopted the Engagement Quality Review Standard. The board has also issued a number of staff practice alerts and has proposed amendments to communications with audit committees, a new standard on confirmation, and concept releases related to the auditor's report and to firms' obligation to supervise their associated persons. Many of these new requirements bear directly or indirectly on auditor objectivity and professional skepticism, but their effects have not yet been reflected in the audits that we have inspected. One approach, therefore, would be for the board not to act on further measures to enhance auditor independence until some of these new requirements have been fully implemented. I'd be interested in commenters' views on this. Other board activities. The work of the board does not stop with the issuance of this release on or review of the comments that we received. The board has at its disposal information generated inside and outside the PCAOB that is invaluable in determining the need for potential effects of measures to enhance auditor independence. As Dan noted earlier in his comments and noted in the release, the board's inspection activities have resulted in findings that include situations that we define as audit failures. PCAOB inspections are designed to focus on high-risk audits and audit issues. They are designed to identify and focus on weaknesses and deficiencies, and our reports that we issue are not intended to serve as a balanced scorecard or an overall rating tool. Thus, our findings may not constitute a representative sample for purposes of drawing conclusions about actual trends. However, in order to determine whether and how such failures can be prevented by enhancing auditor independence, we need to take a close look at the audit failures to determine what the trends are. Is audit quality improving or declining? Is the significance of the audit failures increasing or decreasing? How significant were the audit failures? How many of the audit failures resulted in a restatement, and how many restatements were related to Fortune 500 companies, systemically important banks, banks that received TARP funds, or companies that ultimately filed for bankruptcy or were provided a bailout? Important question, were investors harmed? More importantly, what are the root causes of our findings? Are they the lack of the result of are they the lack of technical competence? Which findings are related to complex areas that everyone struggles to get right, and which ones were the basic and blocking and tackling issues that no auditor should make? Were the findings due to time pressures associated with tight filing deadlines or the result of pressure to reduce fees? And the most important question for today, which findings were likely caused, at least in part, by the lack of objectivity or professional skepticism? Same questions should be asked in the context of our remediation determinations and enforcement actions. Do our findings in those contexts reflect concerns about auditor objectivity and skepticism? We are working on analyzing our data to answer some of these questions. In most cases, we believe the answers will not reflect one cause, but rather a combination of factors. We are also asking firms to conduct their own analysis and would welcome firms to share with us in some of their conclusions as they comment on the release. It is also important to understand how widespread the relevant issues are. The concept release includes one example from an inspection of a firm whose proposals to potential audit clients included statements suggesting the firm's actions would be guided by management wishes. This is a troubling finding, but we don't think it is widespread. I would be interested in commenters' views about how common statements or actions like that described in the release are, as well as other experiences that may reflect a lack of auditor objectivity and skepticism. And do the commenters believe that the problems they have encountered would be eliminated or reduced by mandatory rotation? And if not, what other measures could be effective? Finally, we should continue to monitor and consider the activities and experiences of others as they relate to auditor independence. For example, as noted in the concept release, the European Commission earlier this year issued a green paper that recommends consideration of, among other things, mandatory auditor rotation. In response to the EC's green paper, audit firms and preparers generally opposed mandatory rotation because they believed it would increase costs without improving audit quality. Public authorities had mixed reactions, with some suggesting mandatory rotation may have a positive effect on auditor independence, while others expressed concern about costs and audit quality. The discussion on this issue continues. We are also analyzing academic studies relevant to the question of auditor independence and rotation. As pointed out in the concept release, some academic studies conclude that audit quality tends to increase with audit tenure, including one study focusing on mandatory auditor rotation in Italy. That is in footnote 80, if you're keeping track. Likewise, the concept release points out that in Spain, mandatory auditor rotation was abandoned after 7 years due to increased costs incurred by issuers in connection with auditor rotation. I look forward to receiving what I know will be thoughtful, thorough, and balanced comments in response to this release. I hope we hear from a wide variety of stakeholders. I encourage the firms to talk with their client audit committees and investors and encourage them to respond. And I think this will provide the firms with an opportunity to demonstrate that they put the interests of the audit committees and their investors in their clients first. Finally, I'd like to thank the staff. I won't call them all out by name. It's been done adequately already, and so thank you for your time. And with that, I'm going to cede my time on questions to my fellow board members and turn it back to Mr. Ferguson.
Thank you, Board Member Hanson. I take it when you're discussing what we believe or what we infer from the examples, that's the imperial we. You're speaking for yourself. Questions? Thank you for the time. Mr. Ferguson. Board Member Ferguson.
I have a couple of questions. One, when we talk about, and this is to ask the staff a question about what we have found in our inspection results, when we talk about that we continue to find a lack of objectivity and a lack of skepticism, how often is that, when we find that, how often does that appear to stem from an unquestioning acceptance of management judgments? And are we seeing any trends with respect to that? Has that gotten better over the years? Has that gotten worse? Is that about the same? Can you give us some view about that?
It's probably a little difficult to identify a real trend. I do think that over the years, audit quality has improved. We've seen issues identified and addressed through remediation. We have seen instances of professional skepticism pop up at times, very surprising or shocking instances where we really feel there's a direct link to professional skepticism will pop up almost in random places throughout the inspection. I think a root cause analysis with respect to the items that we identify as audit failures, the items we include in part one of our report, as well as the other deficiencies that we identify in our inspections, is necessary. That is an analysis that we are working on in inspections, and it's an analysis that we've asked all of the large firms to undertake themselves, not just with respect to inspection findings, but with respect to other quality incidences, which might be restatements or litigation-type items.
So the data is not clear. I mean, you're saying basically that you would say you have not seen trends one way or the other with respect to
We're in the process
of management judgments.
Yeah, we are in the process of analyzing the range of data that we've accumulated over the last several years from this perspective in order to identify trends. We've been very focused on this item on a firm-by-firm basis. We are beginning, though, to delve much deeper into root causes and whether the professional skepticism is the only root cause, or it is tied with other root causes, which might include policy or changing economic environment, influences such as workload, are all important to consider.
Then I guess I have a second question for Marty, or for maybe the Office of Research and Analysis, I'm not sure here. There have been examples of countries that have had auditor rotation required. Italy does it now. Spain did it. India, as I understand it, is commencing it as of this summer. Has there been academic work done on looking at the experience there and whether that has affected or you can have demonstrable connections with changes in audit quality? And if so, have we looked at that, and what does that research show?
There has been academic research with respect to the policies that were put in place in those various countries. And the academic research tends to show that there seems to be some increased risk in the early years of change. Michael's done some detailed study of some of that academic research, and why don't you indicate further what you found?
Sure. I think the vast majority of those studies do tend to be focused, as one would expect, on a voluntary rotation environment. And, of course, that's significantly different from a mandatory audit rotation regime, because voluntary rotation can be associated with a number of issues. For example, financial reporting issues, auditor-client disagreements, or economic issues. Now, at the same time, there's also some studies that have been, as you indicated, performed in environments in which rotation is either currently required or was required in the past. And those studies, too, they also reach divergent conclusions. So, for example, one study that focuses on Italy, where mandatory rotation has been in place for more than 3 decades, concludes that audit quality tends to improve with tenure. Now, on the other hand, a study that focuses on Korea suggests that a limit on the length of the auditor-client relationship actually results in greater incentives for auditors to maintain independence. So I think overall, it's not clear from the academic research, and we're interested in that in academic research as we proceed through this project.
Some of those studies use discretionary accruals as a proxy for audit quality, and we've not really found any linkage between discretionary accruals and audit quality and other research that this organization has done. So, again, I'll share Michael's comment that I think the results of that research so far are not conclusive.
Okay. Thank you.
Board, thank you. Board Member Harris.
You want your time back?
No. I'm going to give Jay another chance at the end.
He wants the last word.
But even the last word, yeah.
I think we're all committed, totally committed to an open and transparent process for consideration of this concept release. Could you outline what the process is that you envision for consideration?
Yes, that's a really important question, because as has been indicated by all of us and all of the board members, this is a very important matter requiring significant analysis and significant discovery of facts and significant discovery of issues around this. As Chairman Doty pointed out, there were, according to work done, there was some 6,500 auditor changes during the period of 2003 to 2006. So there's a lot of data out there to be analyzed with respect to how such auditor changes affect risk and cost, et cetera. So there's a lot to be learned. We've intend to put this concept release out for a 120-day comment period ending December 14th. We intend to spend a great deal of time after that analyzing all of the facts and issues and research that comes back into us so that we can then put that forth and have a discussion at a public roundtable in March of 2012, which would look into the issues that came back through the comment period and analyze the comments that were received in great deal during that public roundtable. After that, we'll discuss with the board next steps, which could include further outreach or other steps. So I think it's going to be a very deliberative process, and I think that's the way it should be with a matter as important as this.
Like everyone else, I'm very concerned about the cost implications. However, it's my understanding that mandatory rotation is actually quite common in the public pension and not-for-profit world. Also, that a number of major issuers put their audit out to competitive bidding. So I was wondering if you would provide some examples, and if mandatory rotation is so costly and disruptive, why would these organizations voluntarily change their auditors?
Mike, I can take that one. I think certainly it's an extremely important question, and it's one that the staff's seeking feedback on through this concept release. There's organizations like TIA, CREF, and CalPERS that rotate their audit firms as a matter of policy. And in February of 2009, Apple actually implemented a policy of putting its audit out to competitive bidding every 5 years. We don't know for sure what factors drive those decisions. Some of the entities have said that they implemented the policy in accordance with good corporate governance. But we want to find out more about that through the comment letter process and through the roundtable.
And as I indicated, within the number of voluntary rotations that have taken place, certainly there should be good indicators out there of cost information that has been incurred with those changes that were done voluntarily. And we're hoping to get a lot of insight about that during the concept release comment period.
And I believe strongly in competition and promoting it as much as possible. And I was wondering, what do you believe are the competitive implications of mandatory rotation, and do you think it will increase or decrease competition? And I think the concept release touched upon this with arguments on both sides. But do we have any idea what the competitive implications are? And maybe you could articulate some of the arguments on both sides.
We're looking for information on the competitive aspects of this via the concept release. Some have said that competition could improve through the fact that audits were put out for tendering and put out for bid, and therefore other parties might try to gain the skills and depth of their and capacity needed to take on some of those audits. So some have said it could increase competition. Others have said that, well, by eliminating, if you will, one of the firms, by taking them out of the process to compete, that could have a negative effect, therefore, on competition as well. There's also the factor that some have articulated that in certain industries, maybe only certain firms are known to have the strongest skills in that particular area, and taking one of those firms out of the bidding process in that particular industry might have a negative effect on competition there. So there have been arguments, both pro and con competition, and as with all of this, we're looking for more insight as part of the responses to the concept release on that very important question.
And then have you reviewed Paul Volcker's recommendation and Michel Barnier's suggestion for an audit-only firm approach, and if so, could you explain their proposal and what you believe led them to recommend it for consideration in the first place, and what you believe their underlying arguments for that approach?
Sure, I can take that one. I think the fundamental idea behind an audit-only firm is actually somewhat similar to that behind mandatory audit rotation, auditor rotation, that independence may be enhanced. I think some believe that the provision of any non-audit service by the auditor can affect an auditor's judgment. But at the same time, others have also strongly opposed audit-only firms. They say for the most part it would reduce the talent coming into the profession and would reduce the auditor's knowledge of the company being audited. So there's people on different sides of the debate on that issue too.
One of the aspects of the talent being reduced is the concept that in an audit-only firm, auditors often need, and certainly the large firms have this, auditors need specialists of various kinds to support them, whether they're tax professionals or IT professionals or specialists in analyzing valuation. And if they can only perform those services on audits, whereas otherwise they could be performing them in deeper studies in non-audit services, some would say that those specialists might not join the firm. So there are arguments pro and con the audit only, but clearly the point that some specialists might not be interested in the profession would be a very interesting one.
And then the concept release makes several references to professional skepticism. And I'm wondering, what is the connection between independence and professional skepticism? And then also, isn't what we're talking about here essentially changing the mindset toward a greater focus by auditors on putting investors first and then addressing the issues of professional skepticism?
Hey, Mike. Sure. Well, independence is a description not only of the relationship, but also the mindset, as we've talked about in our presentation. When I talk about a description of the relationship between the auditor and the client, what I mean is that the firm and its personnel must be free from any obligation or interest in the client. And when I talk about an independence of mind, what I mean is that independence in mental attitude that needs to be maintained by the auditor or the auditors. Now, on the other hand, professional skepticism can be described more as an attitude that includes a questioning mind and a critical assessment of the evidence. And our PCAB standards talk about that. They say that in exercising professional skepticism, the auditor should not be satisfied with less than persuasive evidence because of a belief that management is honest. One final point. As well as independence and skepticism, the concept release also talks about this concept of objectivity. And I think the principle of objectivity imposes the obligation to be impartial, intellectually honest, and free of conflicts of interest. But at the end of the day, I think the terms independence, objectivity, and professional skepticism, whilst they all have slightly different connotations, they all relate to the auditor's ability to perform the audit in an unbiased way. And that's what we're looking at through this concept release.
Mr. Chairman, I have got a couple of others, but if they're not asked by others, maybe we can have
another
round.
We'll come back from the room.
Yes,
Mr. Gelser, Board Member Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me begin with something I guess we've all touched on in one way or another. That is what we know and what we don't know from our existing inspection findings about independence questions and the possible need for rotation or other steps to improve independence. I think a number of us have referred to audit failures, and when people see the release, they'll see a statement in it that the board's inspection staff has discovered and analyzed several hundred cases involving what they determined to be audit failures. Could you explain first what audit failure means in this context? What's your definition of an audit failure?
Sure, Dan. Within the release, you're correct. It talks about the audit failures, and the audit failures reference the findings that are typically or that are disclosed in Part 1 of the inspection report. The failures are, we view as being deficiencies where we believe an audit failure has occurred. And how we define that is that is a failure to obtain reasonable assurance about whether the financial statements are free from material misstatement. In other words, in these cases, the firm has not obtained sufficient evidence to support the opinion that it issued on the financial statements it reported on. Our inspection reports do include also other deficiencies, and those are typically included in Part 2 of our report. But in those cases, those deficiencies are not viewed as being audit failures.
So I guess all I'm trying to draw out is if people want to see what we consider to be audit failures, they're in Part 1 of the reports. We're not talking about either more or less than what you'd find by looking at the public part of.
They're all disclosed in Part 1.
And I would say as a footnote, I think the several hundred number in the release is talking about our inspections of either the four or the six largest firms. I'm not sure.
The annual firms.
The 10 or so.
They're the largest. They're the largest firms, yes.
The number would certainly be bigger if we considered the whole.
Correct.
universe.
Effectively, if you added up all of the Part 1 findings over the years of the annually inspected firms, you'd get the several hundred audit failures.
Yeah, okay. And then for those who do get to see Part 2 of the report, I know that doesn't take in most of the public, there are professional skepticism is sometimes frequently discussed, and an attempt is made, at least in some cases, to link the I'll say failures in Part 1 to a lack of professional skepticism, although you'd have to be able to read Part 2 to see that. Do you have any information about how often we've linked specific Part 1 findings to a lack of professional skepticism?
I go back a bit to what Helen was saying earlier with respect to the root cause of a number of the findings. When you look at root causes of the audit failures, they are multifaceted and have a number of different causes or issues. There are a number of cases where we can clearly or have been able to link and see that the professional skepticism was the primary cause of the audit failure. There are other cases where it is a secondary cause. But again, I think as well as we've touched on earlier, skepticism is a state of mind. And at times, unless it's very clear from the work papers, it is a difficult area to measure.
I haven't done a count either. I think if you actually looked at the number that we've linked to professional skepticism, the percentage is fairly small, but I do take your point that we're not able, in the inspection context, to do a kind of a full-blown root cause analysis. And since mental attitude is an invisible factor anyway, even if you had, you know, unlimited time and unlimited access to the data, it might be very difficult to.
Yeah, where we think there's a clear linkage, and especially a linkage that we believe represents a systemic problem, we certainly discuss that with the firm in Part 2 of the report. At other times, though, in the scope of our inspection in particular, depending on what the particular issue was, there might well be professional skepticism problems that are at a root cause level that has not been got at by us or the firm at that time.
Let me approach it another way. There's also a statement in the release, following Jay's lead, page 15, for those who are keeping score, 15-16, I guess, that says that preliminary analysis of the board's inspection data shows no correlation between auditor tenure and the number of comments in PCOB inspection reports. I assume we think that comments are a proxy for audit quality in some way, and the more comments we issue, the lower the quality of the audit. Can anybody tell me a little about this research we've performed that finds no correlation between the two?
I can talk a little bit. It was performed by our Office of Research and Analysis and looked exactly at the Part 1 findings and then looked at the nature of the relationship between the audit client and the auditor, and as indicated, we point out in the document that this is preliminary analysis, did not show that there was a greater number of audit findings, Part 1 findings in earlier years or a lesser number in later years. So it really showed no correlation between Part 1 findings or audit failures and tenure. But I do point out and repeat that it is preliminary analysis, still subject to further review.
We published a research note not too long ago on Chinese reverse mergers. Is this a sort of analysis we might make available to the public as part of this proceeding?
I think the answer to that would be if we completed this analysis and we felt that it was complete, vetted appropriately, and we were comfortable with the conclusions, and if the board agreed, I think this is the type of analysis that could be made available to the public.
I think it might help the debate. I mean, obviously, people are going to have different interpretations or views about the limitations on the data and what it means, but I personally think it would be helpful. Let me turn to something else. There's been some discussion already about marketing materials, and there are quotations in the release from a particular firm's marketing materials that suggest, I don't have it in front of me, but going into partnership with the client and that sort of thing, things that don't perhaps seem consistent with the kind of independent metal attitude that we've been talking about here. Does the inspection staff look at marketing materials or ask for marketing materials as part of an inspection?
We do. I mean, certainly not in all instances. We don't look at all the marketing materials, but in the course of looking at an audit of a new issuer, we would look at the proposals at times on a test basis.
Is that how the ones that are quoted in the release came to light? Through?
Yeah, it's a part of doing our inspection work.
Have you, in your inspections of the annual firms, then, have you found other examples of similar marketing materials?
It is not an area that we have found a widespread problem at all. So looking back over the course of the several years, this, you know, might have come up before, but this was a case where we identified more than one at a time and developed a concern about it such that we felt it rose to a level of significance and importance.
Maybe comment on why you think these marketing materials are relevant to the subject at hand and as why they're in the release. I mean, I guess the theory is that if firms are aggressive about trying to get new clients, that tries sort of drives them into a improper mental attitude that may carry over into the audit. But here, I won't answer the question for you.
Independence is a state of mind, and I think that the state of mind reflected in those marketing proposals is such that we're concerned not only about what the auditor is actually thinking, but what the auditor seems to think a client would want from an auditor relationship. And so those are concerning to us. Really, what does this reflect about what the firm is thinking with respect to independence and reflects, I think, on tone also for the firm.
Do you think if there were to be mandatory rotation, wouldn't there have to be more marketing? I mean, more clients would be up for grabs. It's been suggested earlier in this discussion, there'd be more competition. Isn't it likely we'd see more of this kind of thing as people try to attract new clients?
Well, I think we would certainly see more proposals, more tenders out there. But as these proposals perhaps became more commonplace, it would be important for the auditor to consider the messaging included in the proposals and be mindful of what image they were projecting.
I think that's a good question, Dan. Obviously, there would be more proposals, and I don't think we know the answer to your question, but one might surmise that if the auditor knew that there was a fixed term to their relationship, at least there's the possibility that the proposal might not include so much a state of mind as to what is it you're looking for during our tenure that we can deliver to you, as opposed to we're here to deliver an independent audit and with an independent state of mind for our 10-year period, and we'll go ahead and do it. But I think we're looking for input from many people as part of the concept release on whether that will people think that would occur or not.
A different topic. I mean, I think everybody's talked about our interest in alternatives, and then the release certainly calls for comments on any kind of alternative that would strengthen independence. I mean, the release spends most of its time talking about rotation, but it does talk about other things. I just mentioned briefly in my comments the possibility of what I'll call selective rotation. That is, when we have inspection findings that suggest that there's been an audit failure, there is long tenure, the clients and the firm have been associated for a long time, and the nature of the deficiency of the audit failure seems to suggest a lack of professional skepticism, then perhaps then we could order a change in a rotation, in effect, that the client and the auditor separate. As I think the release notes, this isn't an original idea with me. I think former Chairman Harvey Pitt proposed that in the congressional hearings leading up to the enactment of Sarbanes-Oxley. I just wonder if anybody has a reaction to that as an alternative that might be explored.
I feel bad that Jay Cluster hasn't had a chance to respond to any questions.
His name has come up.
His name has gone up so many times, and it sounds like something that maybe our Office of General Counsel might want to take a shot at.
Sure, Marty. I think, as you note, and as the concept release notes, the board is seeking a very wide range of comment on the kinds of alternatives that could promote or that could enhance independence, objectivity, and professional skepticism. And ideas like the one that you've raised are certainly very worthy of comment and consideration. Since you've asked for an initial reaction to the idea, and I think that the pros of a more targeted approach, like any targeted approach, are that it would likely be less disruptive and costly if you did it on a more targeted basis than simply requiring it across the board on a blanket basis. At the same time, though, as the release notes, it's, and as many others have said this morning, it's not always possible to link a particular audit failure to a lack of professional skepticism, because we can't get inside the head of any particular auditor at any time. And so if the point of the rule would be to encourage a shift in auditors' mindsets across the board as a way of enhancing independence and audit quality, then the more targeted approach might not be as effective in achieving that goal.
I'll go on. Maybe I'll just suggest possible disagreement with you on that last point. I mean, there's been some comment here that auditors don't want to be the guy or the gal who lost the client that's been with the firm for 100 years or whatever. If you knew that you ran that risk coming out of what the PCOB thought of your inspection, just as you ran the risk if you annoyed the client, by disagreeing with its accounting, we might stimulate a change in mental attitude on the part of all auditors without having to impose a requirement automatically on everybody. But I'm sure there are pros and cons to the idea, but I do hope it would be something that that people might consider. Just two final things. In the implementation section of the release, it talks about the fact that if we were to require a rotation, we might have to couple that with prohibiting firms from changing auditors outside the context of the rotation. What's the reason for that?
Well, that's come up in other studies in the past, and I think the concept there is that one might think if the belief is that auditors would do a tougher job and come to the audit with a tougher mental attitude and be less willing to accommodate a client's requests, then they'd run into situations where potentially the relationship might be terminated because of the lack of the auditor to come to agreement with what management or the audit committee thought was the right answer. So I think the idea here would be to protect the auditor who's taking a tough stance with respect to accounting and auditing standards, whether or not this is a possible approach or not, and whether or not it has legal aspects, I think is another matter that's probably out that we'd like to seek a lot of input on. I don't know if OGC wants to comment further on the legal aspects of that.
No, I don't think we certainly don't have any conclusions to offer on that at this point. Again, I think the staff's view is not that it's necessarily a requirement, that it would be a necessary complement to rotation, but it is something, as Marty has said, that's been suggested from time to time, and therefore the concept release describes that view of some people and asks for comment on that issue. And to be sure, if the board came to a conclusion that was a required element, we would have to look more closely at the legal issues Marty rightly raises.
Well, nothing's easy. I mean, the release also suggests that if you had a prohibition against changing auditors, you'd have to have, or probably would have to have, some sort of a for-cause exception tied to that. I mean, have you given any thought to who would decide whether the for-cause criteria were met? Would that be us? Would that be a subject for litigation if there was disagreement about whether for-cause was met or not?
I think the short answer is no. Given the general stage of the concept release, we're seeking broad comment on the idea, and there doubtless are a number of implementation issues of that sort that the staff, at least as far as I'm aware, is not focused on yet or developed a view.
I agree. It's an area we're looking for good input on as part of the comment period.
Last but not least, there's a sort of an intriguing suggestion, I think near the end of the release, that perhaps mandatory rotation would be tried as a pilot program. I wonder what's in mind there. Would that be a mandatory pilot program or a voluntary one? Where would the volunteers come from?
We're hoping some through the comment period, several issuers will volunteer their mandatory rotation for purposes of this pilot period, or some other ideas as to how we might implement a pilot program. But I think it's an idea that was worth putting out in the release to see if a pilot program might be useful, but we're looking for ideas in that regard.
Would they be called kamikaze?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Dan.
I just want to ask Helen one follow-up question to what Dan was saying. And Dan was referencing the part two of the inspection report that we sometimes have a little more discussion to the firm about concerns about professional skepticism and objectivity. What happens with those things that we put in that part two? What does the firm expected to do? Can you just walk us through what that process is?
Well, the short answer is remediation.
What does remediation mean?
Fix the problem. The firm is expected to take in general makes a very good effort to take a corrective action, take action that will be reasonably expected to correct and address the systemic or potentially systemic deficiency that we've identified during our inspections. That work takes place over the course of the year following the issuance of our inspection report. They have a 12-month period.
So we issue a report, and then they've got 12 months to...
They have 12 months to prepare a response, which indicates a formal letter back to us, back to the board, that indicates how they have addressed the specific QC deficiencies that we've identified in part two of our report. We in inspections engage with the firm during that time to the extent that they are interested. We're very interested in engaging with them during that 12-month period. And then following the final submission of that response, we evaluate it and make a determination and bring a recommendation to the board as to whether or not the firm has, in fact, successfully remediated the specific QC deficiency we've identified in our report.
So if you conclude and convince the board that a firm has not sufficiently remediated, what happens then?
Then that deficiency would be made public. And there are on our website part two of certain firm inspection reports which have not been successfully remediated in the past, and those are included on our website.
And if we looked on the website, are there any of these annually inspected firms, the firms that have more than 100 issuer clients on that list right now today?
No.
If I can add just one comment to what Helen said, because we had a discussion about this. The instances that are laid out in the concept release that raise questions about professional skepticism, and while those particular issues that may have given rise to those questions about auditor, lack of objectivity or professional skepticism, those particular issues might have been remediated. That doesn't mean that the firm has necessarily fully remediated the question of professional skepticism broadly. There could be different issues that emerged in a subsequent inspection that also raised questions about professional skepticism. So it was remediation of the particular issues, I think, as opposed to the overall concept. Is that fair?
Yeah. I think that we would look at what was articulated for professional skepticism or any other QC deficiency in part two of our report and evaluate the specific response that was provided to that to determine if that was a meaningful, responsive submission back from the firm.
Steve, you have a question?
How can the board mitigate concerns that rotation might facilitate opinion shopping?
Well, we're certainly seeking input on that, and I'm not sure we can avoid that in general. But, again, the concept of built into mandatory audit rotation is a view, at least a theoretical view, that the auditor would enter that relationship with a different mindset and one that they'd be more independent in terms of their views during their tenure. It wasn't a lifelong tenure they were getting into. And so I think the view there is that the auditor wouldn't get into that engagement only because they succumbed to the view that they thought the client wanted as part of that that situation, given their limited tenure. But we're interested in comment on that. Do you have anything further, Michael?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's divergent views on whether or not mandatory audit firm rotation might result in opinion shopping or not. Some have suggested that it actually prevents opinion shopping because the auditor would have less incentive to accept inappropriate views because management would not be able to select and stick with the one auditor that's willing to relax their objectivity. Now, on the other hand, during the congressional hearings leading up to SOX, there were individuals that expressed the view that rotation would actually lead to opinion shopping. So, as Marty indicated, we're very much interested in people's views on this topic.
And there's another issue that you raised, and that is the concerns that mandatory firm rotation could pose a major challenge to international audit networks performing global audits. And I'm wondering, how can the board gain a better understanding of these challenges and how best to address them?
There have been, amongst the number that Jim threw out before, Chairman threw out before, of changes that have taken place over the years, there certainly have been audit rotations of major multinational audits. So we are interested in particularly in challenges that took place and how they were overcome in those scenarios. Clearly, with audits of major multinationals that have operations in 50 different countries around the world, the implementation issues of getting the right team in place with the right industry skills to take over that new audit and potentially rotate and take people off a different audit to put them onto that creates a lot of implementation challenges on a global basis to manage that. We think it's very important for us to gather a lot of information about how that's been handled in the past, information on how the risks have been mitigated. We talk about certain things in the release as to potential ways these could be mitigated by increased communications between predecessor and successor auditor so that the successor auditor has a greater understanding of the risks around the world and can communicate those better throughout the engagement team. But clearly, there's differences between rotating a small engagement and rotation with respect to the very largest multinational engagements that are literally in most countries around where a company operates in most countries around the world.
And then some have asserted that mandatory audit firm rotation might actually lead to a greater risk of audit failure, especially in the initial years of an audit relationship. If that's the case, what might the board be able to do to reduce that risk?
I think some of what I just discussed was a factor in that in terms of increasing the required communications between predecessor and successor auditor to gain a much better understanding by the successor auditor of the audit risks involved. Other things we might consider doing include we talked about engagement quality review was mentioned before, that time has to take place to see how that has improved audits. There could be a greater level or higher level of supervision, review, or engagement quality review in the early years of the audit to mitigate the risk that might be there in audit rotation. Are there other ideas we have in mind?
I guess one other thing that the board could consider would be staggering the effective date of any requirement to avoid mass rotation on a particular given date. So there's numerous options that you could consider, I think.
Again, we'd be very eager to hear about views in that regard to mitigate those risks as part of the responses to the concept release.
And then finally, Mr. Chairman, we've talked a lot about what we found in terms of our own internal domestic inspections. But I must say I find a disturbing trend in what I hear and read from regulators all over the world regarding the lack of professional skepticism. And I just make a closing comment that we've heard this in reports, as I said before, in Australia, Canada, Germany, the Netherlands, Singapore, and a host of other countries. And quite frankly, we've heard that at the International Forum of Independent Audit Regulators. And so I commend you, Mr. Chairman, for teeing this issue up front and center and for pursuing the open, transparent process that you envision, and in light of what's going on, not only in our own findings, but in terms of global findings, I think it's very important that we consider all alternatives to addressing these issues. So, thank you.
Are there any other thoughts or questions? I want to make two comments. One is there has been some note of the citation of the pitch material in the release, and I think it's a valid question as to why you would include some pitch material from a major firm. Coming as I do from a defense lawyer background, I will tell you that the most oft-repeated and saddest excuse one hears is, everybody does it. If you find a brazen set of pitch materials that say that we offer you the ability to be your advocate and to overcome the objections of your national office, for a skeptical lawyer, you've got to wonder whether, if this exists in the audit of a major firm, whether there's not a cultural phenomenon here in which this particular auditor knows that in his competition and the competitive world he inhabits, everybody does it. Now, I don't think that any of us know how widespread that is, and as Helen has said, we don't look for pitch materials of this kind. But if the independence release has no other effect than to make auditors think twice about what they are promising their clients, it will have done something. The second thing, point to keep in mind is you've heard a lot of discussion here about the alternatives, and I think we're all interested, as the saying goes, and as you have heard, interested in doing what we can and to do minimum harm, as Lou Ferguson said, to do no harm. We want to know what the best alternative is to foster independence. But there's another aspect of the independence release, and that is, if not mandatory firm rotation, then what? The challenge is for the preparer and the audit community to respond legitimately to the requests that we have made for real data and real analysis and to help us analyze what can be done. And for those who have been advocates over the years, over the decades, for mandatory firm rotation, to consider the complexities that are set forth in that concept release. And if the public to which we are speaking and who are interested in the profession that we regulate, if this is a straight up, honest and serious process, then I think you can count on the board here to work through the complexities of it, to listen to each other, to listen to what people are saying, and to come up with a good result. With that, I'll call the question. Would all in favor of the issuance of a concept release please say aye.
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 Any opposed? We are adjourned. Thank you all for attending, and thanks again to the staff on the board.